Today's guest is someone who's never been afraid to challenge the status quo in FM, whether it's how we manage buildings, build culture, or balance purpose with profit. Andrew Hulbert is the founder of Pareto FM, a company that's been making waves with its social-led, relationship-based approach since 2014. He's also played a major role with IWFM, launching the Tomorrow Meets Today initiative to support emerging leaders and spent the last decade pushing the industry to think differently. In this episode, we're digging into the reality of FM right now, from budget pressures and sustainability goals to the rise of AI and the big conversations the sector still isn't having. Let's get into it. Andrew.
Hello.
Welcome to the FM Fix.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Great.
How did you get into the world of facility management?
It's a good question. I ask myself that sometimes as well. Very brief story. I was at university studying business studies and I came across something called the Shell Step Scheme, which put second year undergraduates with SMEs in any sector. And I got linked up with a facilities management company called Rollright. It was a £6 million little FM company over in Oxfordshire. And I went to the interview. There were only two people that applied for the role and you needed a car to get the job. And luckily, I was the only one with the car. So I got the job and I went and did 8 weeks with Rollright to do a competitor analysis on the sector. Knew nothing about facilities management whatsoever. And I just saw this sector that I just thought there's so much opportunity here, so much going on, so much money being spent, things like energy management and people management. And it really caught my attention when I was in my very early 20s. So I finished my degree, went back, and luckily for me, Rollright offered me a permanent job as a graduate, and I chose to go back in. And that's how I started my career. And I'm very proud. They say the stats are about only 3% of people come directly out of education straight into the facilities management sector, certainly from a graduate level. So I count myself as very proud as one of the few people that did that and actually chose this sector.
That's low, 3%.
Oh, well, absolutely.
So what could the education system do better to attract more people into the industry?
Yeah. I think the 15 or so years that I've been doing FM, you know, it's still the age-old question, how do we get more graduates into the sector? The challenge we have as a sector is we're not like law or medicine or pharmacy where you have to go and get an education and come in. People often fall into FM as often as the story is told. So for me, we have to continue to sort those pathways out for educational purposes about how people come in. And I look to the likes of the Netherlands. So the Netherlands take on 500 FM undergraduates every year. Now, in the UK, I think we're less than 30 at the moment. So the Netherlands really sees facilities management as a career of choice. And people want to often go into operations in FM management or hotel management is another popular course. And with Pareto, we partner with Breda University, which they take on 100 undergraduates a year themselves. And we go and see all the latest innovations and what the students are saying. But from the UK perspective, I think we still have a lot to learn. We have a lot to do in terms of investment. And whilst there are better higher education courses at MSc and MBA level, that undergraduate level to try and get people into the sector is still lacking a bit. And if we look to our European friends in the Netherlands, they're absolutely smashing it in that respect. And I think we could learn a lot still.
Absolutely. So what inspired you to launch Pareto?
It's a good question. I launched Pareto about 10 years ago now. So it's been quite the journey in that time. The inspiration really came. So I mentioned I went to Rollright, that small FM business. And by about 4 years into that, I was ops director and I was looking after 250 staff. And I loved it. I had all this responsibility. I was getting pay rises. I was getting bonuses. I was really enjoying myself. And I was working every hour that was available and weekends and everything. But I had a lot of responsibility at an early age. Rollright was successful and we grew it from 6 million to 12 million turnover. And then it sold to a big company. And I did 2 years in that big company environment. Now, whilst that company was great as an organization, I just didn't enjoy that big company mentality compared to the SME environment that I'd grown up in. And when I was at school and university, the only subject I really thrived at was business. And I always knew I wanted to start my own business one day. So I think I was 26, 27, and I was getting frustrated and I wasn't really getting anywhere in this big company. And I just wasn't feeling this was going to be the future career for me. So I went home one day to my wife and I said, I'm going to give 3 months notice and I'm going to start a business from my bedroom with no funding, no plans, no help.
What was her reaction?
She was not particularly happy. We're approaching 20 years of our relationship now. We're still together. But I just said to her, look, I'm at a stage, we didn't have any kids at that stage, which I think is a really important part of entrepreneurship as well. I just said, I need to do it now. And if the worst case scenario for me is that I lose all my money, lose my house, lose my marriage, I am going to put that on the line at this stage to try and see if I can make this thing grow. And yeah, literally, I went and handed my notice in. I worked my 3 months notice and I launched Pareto in August 2014. And I mean it, it was literally me, a laptop, no money, funding, people, processes, risk assessments, banking, literally nothing. And I built it up and I managed to go back and I had an old relationship with Bulgari Hotel in Knightsbridge. So it had recently been built. I knew the chief engineer there. And he's called Jeff, and he very, very kindly gave us our first contract. And it was a couple of £100,000 a year contract, the very first one that we had. And I will always be so grateful to Jeff, because without him, I don't know if we ever would have properly launched. But yeah, that's how it all started. And predominantly the reason was that I thought the market wasn't served particularly well by the big FM companies. And there wasn't brilliant focus on ESG or social value, which weren't even really phrases 10 years ago in terms of what we got now. And I felt there was a market for SMEs, particularly supporting tech organizations, because, you know, like with Expansive, tech organizations want to do things in their own way. And I think if you can offer flexibility as well as brilliant ESG and social value, then there's a concept there that would work. So for us, we got lucky, it worked, and Pareto grew and grew and grew. And I'm sure we'll come on to other parts of the story. But yeah, we went on to be one of the most successful organizations within the UK and specifically within the FM sector.
What are you most proud of from Pareto's journey so far? But also, I'm keen to get your perspective on what were some of the most challenging moments.
Yes, start with pride. Pride is the people, without any question. For any entrepreneur out there that's thinking of starting their own business, you think you're good at certain stuff, and maybe as an entrepreneur you are, and maybe your superhero skill is that you work really hard. But entrepreneurs are really bad at getting out of their own way and letting other people do things, because we always think we're going to do it better. And if you speak to any of my team that came on the journey, they'll tell you I was the biggest control freak that there was. and that's a challenger with entrepreneurship. And I'm sure many people resonate with that. But what I'm proud of is the people that joined us early. And often I remember feeling a sense of responsibility, because people were leaving big companies, established jobs, you know, great salaries, to come and join my little startup, which I believed it was going to work, but I didn't truly deep in my heart know it was going to work. So I felt that they were taking a bit of a risk. And what I really enjoyed is we often took people on that weren't typically your FM people that would usually get senior management jobs. And the idea of that was we built one of the most diverse senior leadership teams that there was within the whole sector. So when we were talking about ESG and social value and EDI, it wasn't just a paper exercise for us. It was real. We were like, here are our 15 senior leaders. You know, there are so many different areas of diversity that are covered within here. And what we wanted to do was break that glass ceiling very early to show that anybody who was marginalized in any way could reach the top of our business, and they could help to set what the culture was like. And, you know, often in a business, when you look up, you can't see yourself. And for me, it was really important that when anybody looked up, they could see part of themselves in someone else. So there was no way of stopping people from getting there. And that's what I'm most proud of, because many of those people today who are household names in facilities management now, they were relatively unknown when they joined, and they went on this incredible journey with us. And now they're part of the industry. They're at the top of the industry. And I'll forever be grateful for the effort that they gave us, and also just the fact that they took a chance. And that was a really, really important thing for us. In challenges was the second one. Crikey. I've made a lot of mistakes along the way, as we do as entrepreneurs. I remember trying to set up the bank was a complete pain in the ass, frankly, and trying to get people paid was hard work, working with like early payroll providers. And I remember I used to do all the payment runs for all the suppliers, which was a stupid thing for me to do, but that's what I did. And the first time I paid everybody, I forgot to pay the VAT on all of the invoices. So I sat there on a Sunday typing away, and we had about 20 invoices come back saying you've missed 20% off. The real challenges come with growth. Pareto grew from seed to what, 50 million in 9 years?
Yeah.
And we grew from seed to 550 staff in that time as well. So literally, when you are growing that quickly, some years we were growing 300% year on year, it is quite difficult to make sure that you put lots of processes in place that help you to get to that next level. When I started, I always talked about trying to get to 20 million turnover. And we called that the Premier League in terms of using football analogies, so that people could understand that we wanted to act as a 20 million pound business from day one. So the processes and the systems and everything we put in place would get us to 20 million. Now, just as it happened, 20 million is roughly when we got our first private equity investment, and we got to that stage. And then we grew from 20 million to 50 million in about 2.5 years, 3 years. So we had really quick growth during that time. So in that time, the challenge is you need to hire good people. You need to trust those people to do a good job. You need processes that are always bigger than your business currently is, because you're not standing still. And also, you need to find customers that are going to accept that you're going on this journey together and that you are going to just grow and grow. And actually, a lot of the customers that we worked with, the reason we grew so quickly was because we started small with them, and then they just kept giving us more and more and more services. And we would grow contracts from 100K a year to 5 million a year quite regularly within Pareto, because we would take customers on, tell them what our story was. And in the end, they wanted to support us and they wanted to go on that journey with us. But yes, for me, it will always come back to people. You need to find great people, treat them well, make sure you have a diverse team, reward them for what they do. But those people should expect to work hard. And, you know, I was the sort of guy that on a Saturday night, if I WhatsApped at 11 o'clock at night, I would expect a response. But if you came to me on Monday and said, really sorry, my kid's sick, I can't come in today, I'd be like, absolutely no problem. Do you want me to send some chocolate for them to try and help them through the day? It was that sort of relationship with that very senior team.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, we've implemented very similar culture at Expansive.
Yeah.
You know, giving people the flexibility, the responsibility and the accountability to make decisions.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, your business is only ever going to be as good as the people you bring in. And I think when you're starting up, you've got to get those A-list team members in.
You do.
Because A-list attract A-list. And if you bring someone who's not an A-list, it absolutely it can really impact, you know, the whole business's performance. Yes.
Well, I mean, we used to have a phrase, and actually we sort of stole it from Deliveroo. Deliveroo in the early days when we worked with them had a sign on their wall that said, give a shit. That's what it said in big letters, give a shit. And we used to have this phrase that we said, we don't employ dickheads.
Yeah.
So if anybody was being sort of out of line with what the Pareto culture was, we sort of turn it around and say, hey, come on, this isn't how we act here. And, you know, there's a lot of management theory written around a toxic person can be a lot worse than a really good person can be really good, for example. So basically, you need to take those toxic people out quite quickly so that you can keep the culture as it is. Because as soon as people start seeing behaviours that are not in line with what your culture is, that's how your culture changes. And that's how good people leave, because they get frustrated that, you know, we're not following the culture.
Correct. I want to get your views on some of the industry trends. So how do you see artificial intelligence impacting facility management?
This is a really interesting area for me, because I embraced AI a couple of years ago, and really I'm self-taught and no formal training, but I give various courses and talks on it and things. For me, a lot of the industry claims to be experts in AI, but they talk about AI about 5-10 years down the line, whereas AI is here now in terms of the different things that you can do. And I find it a little frustrating that we have so-called experts within the sector that actually know very little about it. And I wrote an article recently in one of the main magazines about the 7 AI things you can implement today, not in the year's time. For me, automation of things like BMS and crunching data on a really regular basis to understand what it all means, space utilization, you know, going into offices and closing floors down on an hourly or daily basis to make sure we don't overuse on energy. The function around energy management and energy use, which will continue to be incredibly important. And in the IWFM Outlook surveys that we do, we know the top out of the top 5 things that are most important to people in this sector, the top 4 are energy related. So utility usage, energy, decarbonization. So AI has such an important role to play in all of that. Do I think AI is going to be running around fixing air conditioning units? No. Do I think it's going to be cleaning offices? No, I don't. None of those things. What we have to do is embrace the power, and we have to do it. But also, I think, you know, AI is still really in its infancy and it changes so quickly that it's hard to really know what the truth is. This is a ridiculous story, but I was just in Vienna with two friends over the weekend and we had an hour to kill before we were going to go back on the plane. So we said, oh, let's go bowling, just something silly. It was raining, so we wanted to go inside. So I quickly said to ChatGPT, I was like, hey, I'm in this area of Vienna. Can you tell me where a good bowling alley is? So we follow the instructions, we go to this bowling alley. It turns out it's a local Skittles alley. Where there were lots of locals playing there. And as we walked in, there happened to be an event which was focused on people with learning disabilities playing Skittles in that place. So we walked in there like we were going to play bowling and it was just completely the wrong place to be. Now, it just made me laugh. And I said to my friends, I said, I'll tell that story one day because that's what AI has the power to also do. It can think it interprets what you're saying and actually can make things go very differently. And I think there has to be a warning around all of that. And look, I just think the other thing with content creation, you know, like the ability for AI to create content is incredible. From essays to writing books to children's stories and everything in between. And I've used it for various things. We just have to make sure that we're keeping the humanistic aspect of that. And yes, it may be great to get AI to write 80% of your wording, but you need to make sure that it's fit for purpose, that it's relevant, that it doesn't have silly grammar and stuff in it, which often is the case. And you can really tell AI language within LinkedIn and things quite easily. So it's here to have a massive impact. I think people probably don't realize how much impact it could have today. I'm skeptical about whether it will mean we don't have engineers or security guards or cleaners in the future. I think we still will.
I completely agree. AI is here right now.
Yeah.
And the FM industry needs to get on board more.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting because you've got to adopt it responsibly.
Yes.
And, you know, Eric Schmidt, I think a few days ago, spoke and said it's going to consume 99% of the world's energy.
Yeah.
So I think businesses need to adopt it responsibly.
Yeah.
So, and we know that the built environment already contributes to circa 40% of emissions.
Yeah.
So what's actually working when it comes to driving sustainability in FM?
Again, this is another area I'm skeptical. For me, there's an awful lot of greenwash, a lot of green marketing, and a lot of companies claiming things that are just not true, let alone what we're doing at a governmental level in terms of, like, you look at Scotland, I think it's moved its net zero target 7 times. The UK is unlikely to hit its 2050 targets as well for net zero. What I'm seeing working on a smaller level is companies like Pareto. They are genuinely going on a net zero journey. So they're working with companies like PlanetMark, which anybody can use, and they'll take you on a 3-year journey from where you are to net zero. And now for smaller companies, for SMEs, that is brilliant because everything is still controllable in terms of what you do. The challenge we have is those larger organizations that are turning over billions worldwide. How do you truly understand what their footprint is, what their supplier base is, what their supplier's carbon footprint is? And there's a real challenge from that perspective. Even at someone like Pareto, we got 1,000 suppliers. So with 1,000 suppliers, how do we know what their carbon footprint is in the first place, let alone what contribution of that footprint is our footprint in our Scope 3? So what I am seeing is some organizations committing to the net zero journey now, that will mean that hopefully in 3 to 5 years, they'll be there. But just as much, you can go on any major FM company's website and read a whole ream of marketing stuff about sustainability that actually means very little. And they will struggle to hit their targets of net zero by 2050. And the cost of offset will be into the millions to be able to get them to that stage. So I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen anything that truly inspires me and I go, wow, it's going to be okay. But I think SMEs can lead the way here because they can show bigger businesses and clients what they can do. And there are many, many examples of great SMEs in FM that are actually starting to do this in a good way.
Equality, diversity and inclusion is something that's evidently super important to you.
Yes.
And one of the main reasons or differentiating factors why you founded Pareto. What are some of the meaningful ways in which the FM industry can adopt EDI beyond the policy docs and the training sessions?
Yeah. It's a really good point. Look, my EDI, I sit here as a straight, white, middle-aged, middle-class, neurotypical male. And I can't do anything about that, but that's who I am. When I grew up in an incredibly diverse environment, and I count myself very lucky from that, from, you know, council estate family, working class family. My friends were from all sorts of different backgrounds, and my school had lots of different children in it. And I just feel incredibly lucky that I grew up in a really diverse environment. And that for me just made those things normal, you know, in terms of like if I encountered someone who was neurodiverse, for example, that was completely normal to me. And I'm incredibly tolerant. For me, look, in the last, 8 weeks, we've seen EDI roll back more than we have done in the last 20 years. You know, like it's quite incredible the changes that have come out of the US. And I did a talk recently where I did some research on major brands and the rollbacks that they've done. And these are very real. So for me, EDI, it is so critical that we have groups that are mixed and diverse to create creativity within the business environment. And that's not just ethnicity. That is all sorts of different backgrounds and challenges. And the way I see it, if I'm in a room with 20 other people that all have the same background as me, we're all going to think the same way. We're not going to be creative. We're not going to challenge each other. And that's why for me, Pareto was so successful early doors, because we had all this different backgrounds and different focuses, and people had faced different challenges in different ways. Personally, I think with all of the rollbacks that we're seeing from the US, which will filter through to the UK, there's a real opportunity again to lead on EDI right now. And the reason that facilities management is so well placed is because we have the people, right? We employ hundreds of thousands of millions of people in this sector. Often those people are low wage workers, and those people may be diverse for various different reasons. But we have a responsibility as FM to look after those people and to promote them and elevate them and make sure that the world sees them for how incredible they are. And for me, that will never change. And you can change your policies, you know, you can fall in line with the US and all that sort of stuff. But there is nothing as powerful as being sat in front of somebody who may have a marginalized characteristic themselves, and you have representation on your side, and you can see you're going to go on this amazing journey together, whether that's staff member to staff member, client to client, client to contractor. It's all about creating those opportunities for people who face different challenges to work together and be creative. And personally, if I was starting all over again, I'd go even harder next time, because that is that for me just works. And you resonate with people on a level that you could take the best corporate brochure you could ever possibly want into a sales pitch. If you can resonate with someone on an emotional level for something that they felt challenges with, that is a way that you win business every single time and you beat the competition.
What more would you do?
I think for me, I'd probably go B Corp really early, because B Corp, as we all know, is a real challenge. And anybody who's been through it knows how much of a challenge that is. I'd also adopt. So we ran a scheme called the Kickstart Scheme in the middle of Pareto, which was about getting 30 very diverse people into the business who are age 16 to 24. And really focus on like the apprenticeship side of things. I would do that much earlier, because I think the more people you meet like that, the more opportunities you have for to find superstars, to give opportunities to people. And look, as business people, let's face it, if you can bring someone in on a 20K salary who's going to work really hard and be a brilliant part of your business that's going to go on and be a huge success, that's a very affordable way to bring people in. And you're not paying recruitment fees and you're not having to try and retrain people all the time. So yeah, for me, I'd probably just focus even heavier on the EDI, and I'd focus on bringing younger people in early and to help them go on the journey. But I definitely would go for a similarly diverse team again.
What conversations are we not having enough in FM today?
That's a really good question. I go back to sustainability on this point. I think net zero in particular feels like an issue for the next generation, because it's 25 years away from us being able to deliver it. And I think a lot of people are making promises now that they'll be retired when those promises need to come good. I think we need to get honest with ourselves and we need to understand it. The other thing is the age demographic within the FM sector. So the last stat I saw, 50% of people in the sector are over 45. Now, they're a very, very important part of the sector, but it does mean that in 25 years, half the sector is going to retire. So what does that mean for the rest of us, you know, that are still going to be there and working? And I think use of the apprenticeship levy and bringing in younger people, I think, is something that we're just not good enough at. And again, there's lots of studies shown, but we waste millions, if not billions, in the FM sector with unused apprenticeship levy that we've paid to the government that we're then not using to train people on and bring new apprenticeships through. So I think there's a ticking time bomb for net zero. And I think there's a ticking time bomb for the age demographic. And I look around at this sector and I look at the opportunities I had as a 21-year-old and the journey that I've been on since then. I'm 39 now. There is opportunities there. Doesn't matter what your background is, what your educational background is. If you want to come and work incredibly hard, FM is the place for you. And you're not going to be surrounded. Say you haven't gone to university, you're not going to be surrounded by 80 other people that have. You're going to be surrounded by people like you that have worked hard to get there. And I think that's really powerful.
And this is one of the reasons why we decided to launch the FM Fix, is to elevate facilities and elevate that noise and tell real life stories like you're sharing today. And hopefully what we can see and what we can encourage is to get more people who want a career in facilities management.
And it's worth me, you know, I'm vice chair on the IWFM. Yes. I have been for a few years. And one of the major changes, this may be a question of yours, but one of the major changes I've seen within the sector in the last 10 years or so is there is a defined educational pathway now as we go through the facilities management sector. The IWFM levels 2 through 7 are really defined and people know that they're there. And I've mentored many people that have gone from, you know, 4 to 6 to do an MBA and all that sort of stuff. Now, that didn't exist when I first joined the sector. And I go back to trying to say we need more undergraduate courses to bring people in so they can go on that journey. But there is a definition. And I love this idea that someone comes out of college, they've done all of their educational stuff. They happen to find themselves as a receptionist in a corporate office. They're actually part of the FM team. They didn't really realize that was the case. They can go on an amazing journey. And believe me, some of the best people I've met in the whole sector who are the most technically successful are people who've started as an admin and they started on a help desk and they've learned FM and they've worked their way up. And that's incredibly powerful, you know, especially when they learn good CAFAM systems and they learn good CAFAM management. It's a skill that never leaves them, because even if you're a very senior manager in facilities management, you need to understand how tasks are managed, how PPMs are closed down, how reactives are done, how billing is done, you know, and those things are just absolutely critical on that side.
I think we need more people like you to tell the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, go into schools, go into universities and promote the FM sector.
We've done a few with IWFM, we've done a few like school careers fairs. And it's a really interesting reaction. I've been there genuinely when some children come over to us or young people come over and the parents will usher them away from the stand because the parents are like, well, I don't want my child to be a cleaner. You know, they're going to be more than that. And actually, there's a whole sector out there that they just don't understand. And being a cleaner is an amazing way to start within facilities management as you get to know people. And one thing I always think around the cleaning sector, I remember early doors, I went to Sony PlayStation's Christmas party. We used to deliver cleaning there back in my early career. And I walked around with the two cleaners who we'd gone with. They were like celebrities. There's 1,000 people there. Every time they walked past someone, they were stopping for selfies. And I just thought, yes, this is the power of what people can do within this. And there is a defined route for people in this sector to move forward as well.
I want to talk about something that you're very passionate about. Mm. I've seen on LinkedIn that you're very passionate about giving blood and the importance of giving blood.
Yes.
How did you start and why?
Yes, good question. I tell the truth. So when I was growing up, one of my best friends, his mother passed away when we were quite young. And he encouraged all of us to donate blood from about the age of 18 as a result of what happened. And I didn't want to at the time. And I didn't know why. And I still don't really know now. But I just didn't feel my body was ready. I was still very early. I was nervous about it, et cetera, et cetera. 18 years passed. And I was at the age of 36. And Pareto was celebrating Black History Month, as we did. But we wanted to do something real in Black History Month rather than just put a flag up and all that sort of stuff. So we took it as the time to introduce our blood donation policy. And what that meant was that people were able to take free time off work to go and donate blood. And specifically, we were trying to encourage the Black members of our team to go and donate to help with sickle cell disease, because only 44% of the population are able to donate for sickle cell disease blood. And we just need to keep encouraging it from that area. So we started it and I thought, look, as CEO, I need to actually do it myself. And I went and donated for the first time and it was whole blood at the time. So where they take a pint of your red blood out effectively. And I just had the most amazing time. And I went there and everyone was really happy. They were so grateful that you were there. There was loads of biscuits, which, you know, for people who know me, I love my food and drinks. And, you know, NHS is a challenging environment sometimes and not everybody loves the NHS. But I went there and it was almost like a party. I was like, yeah, I want to be part of this. I absolutely love it. And then as a man, you can only donate whole blood every 3 months. So I did my next two donations and I was thinking, this is great, but I want to do this more. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3" and 18 stone, right? So there's plenty of me here. And I was giving my third blood donation and the nurse said to me, have you heard of platelets? And I said, no. And she's like, look, platelets are the stuff in your blood that clogs your blood if you cut yourself, basically. And in fat men, there are lots of extra platelets. Now, what we can do is we can harvest those platelets out and then we can give those to people that are receiving cancer treatment, often children that are receiving cancer treatment as well. I was like, yeah, sounds good. And they took a sample and my platelet count was at a good level. Now, with platelets, you're not able to just donate every 3 months. You can donate every 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Because as long as your platelet levels recover, which they do, then you can donate every 2 weeks. And when you donate whole blood, it can save 3 lives per bag. But on platelets, it can save 12 lives per bag. And because of my size, when I go and donate platelets and plasma, they come out together, I don't just donate one bag, I donate three. Because of my size, I can get 3 bags out of me each time in a safe way. So I'd just gone from donating 4 bags of blood a year, which could help 12 people, to 26 times a year donating 3 bags that could help 36 people each time. So I'm currently one of the biggest blood donors in the world. And because I've donated every 15 days for the last 9 months, so you cannot donate more. And you cannot donate more blood each time that you go. So when you start throwing those stats in, you're just like, yeah, shit, I have a responsibility to do this. I'm healthy. I live my life in a way that means I can donate blood because many things you can't do. And even down to like taking ibuprofen and paracetamol and stuff. But I'm not a drug user. You have to be really careful around things like sexual partners and stuff. All those things. For me, I live a great life where I can continue to donate regularly. And so I just caught the bug. And so now I'm up to I did my 60th donation on Monday. And each time you get a little badge when you get to a certain criteria. So I've got my 50th badge. But I know men in there because it's in the platelet cycle, it's mainly men. After women have had babies, their hormones change and are not able to donate platelets. I met a guy, he's done 1,000 donations. He's an older guy. And I was like, fair play to you, because that is 1,000 occasions you've gone in there and donated blood. And that is a lifetime that you are supporting people. So for me, people don't always know about platelets and plasma. And as soon as I was educated on it and I knew I could go every 2 weeks. But look, ultimately, as an entrepreneur, I'm competitive. So I'm only competing with myself, but I now prioritize blood donations. So I don't know, let's just say I'm donating on a Saturday night. I can't go out and get really drunk on the Friday because you can't have alcohol the day before when you're donating. Things like tattoos and piercings and all that sort of stuff, you just have to be really careful on. I also feel if you're fortunate enough to be able to donate, because there are many reasons that people can't, I just feel you have a responsibility to help out. Now, I'm not saying everybody needs to go and donate platelets every 2 weeks. Absolutely not. I did a post on LinkedIn just yesterday. Some blood level stocks that we have in the whole of the UK, we have 2.5 days of stocks left. That's it. So if we had a major, I think it's O negative, if we had a major issue where we needed lots of O negative blood, for some reason there was a major incident, it's only 2.5 days available in a normal scenario. So it just proves how low critical we are on stocks. And they want to keep at least a week's supply of everything. And, you know, it's not unusual for me because I'm a big foodie and donuts and stuff. Every time I donate every 2 weeks, I take them food, I take them donuts, I take them Easter eggs. I went into M&S on the way in this week and all their Easter eggs were reduced. So I just bought everything that was there and gave it to them. But, you know, they're great people. And in terms of the nurses that administer it all, and I love it. I just love being there. I love posting about it. And, you know, there are many people who've either received blood or their families have or their kids have. And they come and they say thank you. And that's really powerful for me. And as I move into the world of non-executive directorship, as I'm doing at the moment, I want to keep building a legacy of leaving things behind, that when I tell my children about these things in the future, you know, they're going to be proud of that. And I hope that, you know, it inspires other people to do it, because I just think it's an amazing thing.
And it really is an amazing thing. And you should be exceptionally proud.
No, thank you.
And I really do mean that. Now, we have a closing tradition.
Okay, closing tradition. Wow.
It's quick fire questions.
Right.
No thinking.
Okay.
Just answer.
Yeah.
If you could change one thing about the FM industry today, what would it be?
That we had more people coming in directly from education that really cared about the sector and wanted to be part of it.
What gives you hope about the future of FM?
the hope is the people. I meet so many amazing people, certainly through the IWFM, that are just incredibly passionate about what they're doing. They work so hard. I know they want to make a difference, and they will make a difference. And they're brilliant as well. And that's what's amazing about these people. They are brilliant.
And what's your bold prediction for the FM industry?
Oh, bold prediction for the FM industry. I think that we will have to have a lot more sustainability management as part of what we are as a facilities management profession. So I think that there'll be hopefully more people coming from the sustainability route into the facility sector. And what that will ultimately do is build this super layer of sustainability experts within the facilities management division that will continue to show its strategic importance to the organization. Because when the FD is coming down and saying, why are we wasting so much on utilities? We have brilliant people that are able to say, this is a way that we can try and fix it. So sustainability is the future for me.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the FM Fix. I've learned a hell of a lot. It's been really interesting. You've told some great stories.
Thanks.
And really appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's been great. Thank you.
Great.